Security crackdown in Iraq. We're going to have a report from Baghdad in a few minutes. We'll also have at that time news, interesting news from a press conference that was held in Baghdad. But first, Iraq, the economy, the Scooter Libby trial. President Bush was asked about all of those and more this morning at his first news conference of the year. One question that dominated: is the Bush administration slanting the intelligence on Iran in order to attack Iran in order to attack Iraq? The Pentagon's top general, Peter Pace, appears to have contradicted a briefing in Baghdad this past weekend in which U.S. intelligence agents alleged that the highest levels of the Iranian government were involved in sending explosives to Iraq. CNN correspondent Ed Henry pressed the president to clarify.
There's no contradiction that the weapons are there and they were provided by the Quds force.
What assurances can you give the American people that the intelligence this time will be accurate?
Ed, we know they're there. We know they're provided by the Quds force. We know the Quds force is a part of the Iranian government. I don't think we know who picked up the phone and said to the Quds force, go do this, but we know it's a vital part of the Iranian government. What matters is that we're responding. The idea that somehow we're manufacturing the idea that the Iranians are providing IEDs is preposterous, Ed. My job is to protect our troops.
Well, joining us now is Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Holly, we're getting all sorts of different information coming at us today about the charges of Iran's involvement in Iraq. The Associated Press is reporting that a portion of the intelligence that was presented this week was left out in the packet that was sent to General Pace. He didn't know that agents were pointing a finger at Iranian government officials. And a little later in the program, we're going to talk to Borzu Daragahi, who's in Baghdad. He says that there was a press conference there today in which U.S. officials seemed to really back off allegations against the Iranian government's involvement. So what more was the president asked today? What more did he say?
Well, I just want to speak on that issue. I mean, what's striking to me about all of that is that the administration doesn't really seem to have its act together on where they are with Iran. I mean, you do have General Pace sort of contradicting, what the White House has said in terms of, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow was sort of backing up that a briefing in Iran on Iraq. But it's just fascinating, after all the problems that we've seen with the intelligence on Iraq and the questioning about that, that they didn't have all their, T's crossed and I's dotted on this.
We understand a large dossier of information about Iran explosives was rejected by Defense Secretary Robert Gates. He questioned some of the information in it.
Right, and it's surprising. It's surprising. And the president was indeed asked about that, but he said, while he doesn't have a direct, they don't have proof of a direct connection from the leaders of Tehran, they know that, their intelligence that they're examining shows that at least some of the equipment has been sent by Iran. So that's where we are today.
Well, and given that there are questions of a very serious nature about, a possible attack against Iran, did the tone of the president surprise you at all? He was joking with reporters, which he does quite well, but he gave a little laugh when he was first asked about Iran, or at least that's how it sounded.
Well, it was striking what a good mood the president was today. But I also think just the larger context, is appropriate. I mean, the president has been obviously under fire lately from even Republicans in his party, not just Democrats. He's been getting the worst press. His poll numbers are, down in historic lows. But I think it's important for him to sort of have, project the image that he's sort of shrugging all of this off and that he's not bothered by the noise, as he described it in an interview with C-SPAN earlier this week. So, I mean, part of that, we have seen the president sort of jokey and humoring with reporters before. But, yeah, it was surprising that he was in such a good mood today.
Well, what's surprising to many as well is that the White House is, at least supposedly, not lobbying hard against the current non-binding resolution that's being debated in the House. The House is now in day two of that debate on a non-binding resolution opposing the president's troop increase in Iraq. And we're going to have sound from that debate later in the program as well. But was he asked about that? And what are your thoughts on, whether or not the White House is less or more involved than people expect?
Well, he was asked about it, and he sort of repeated what he had said earlier in the week, that he knows that Congress is going to do what it's going to do in terms of this debate. He noted that it was more of a symbolic resolution as opposed to binding resolution. But I think what's interesting is that the White House is very involved in this debate. They may not be out front and strong-arming people, but they are definitely involved. They have very close ties to John Boehner, who is the leader of the Republicans in the House. They have close ties to Mitch McConnell, who was handling it all in the Senate. What's important on that level is that Republicans in Congress have made clear to the White House that they want to have more control, and they don't want to have it seem that the White House is controlling and pulling all the strings. They want to have it all the sort of debate center from the House or the Senate, just so that they can have some distance there.
Well, one last question. We learned yesterday that Vice President Dick Cheney isn't going to testify in the trial of his former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, who is, again, accused of lying about the leaking of the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. Was the president asked about this or the trial, and what was his response?
He was asked, and again, he had a no comment on that. But it's going to be interesting as this trial winds up how long the White House can continue to sort of hide behind those no comments. They've not commented on this, saying it's an ongoing investigation, it's ongoing legal proceedings. But as soon as this wraps up, I mean, they really can't say that anymore. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens when this is all wound up.
Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. You've got a couple of seconds. Was there something that was asked that surprised you?
Just essentially the question about, you know, whether the president regards, you know, comments on the war as emboldening the enemy. You know, a lot of members of his administration have suggested that any kind of debate or a disagreement with the president on this is emboldening the enemy. The president sort of backed off from that.
He did. Holly Bailey, again, Newsweek magazine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's Valentine's Day, which means that millions of single Americans may be going to dating websites, including Match.com. Indian Americans might head to Shadi.com, IndiaMatrimony.com, or PunjabiMatrimony.com to seek out arranged Valentines. The time-honored tradition of arranged marriages is vibrant in America, and we're going to take a closer look at the whole issue today, starting with an overview. Robin Goodwin is professor of social psychology at Brunel University in London. He's the author of the book Personal Relationships Across Cultures, and he joins us from London. Professor Goodwin, first of all, how popular are marriages arranged by parents or a third party around the world?
Well, in fact, they're practiced in large parts of the world, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Far East and Malaysia, parts of China, a lot in parts of Africa.
Well, two of the concerns that usually come to mind when one thinks of arranged marriages are children being betrothed and dowries causing families ruin because they can't afford them. So how, for instance, in India, how are those two issues handled now?
Well, it depends on state and it depends on different enforcement of the regulations as well. It's also going to depend on, of course, the different religions within India. The Muslims are more likely to desire an arranged marriage than the Hindus in general. But in fact, this process is changing very rapidly. And so what was previously seen as acceptable behavior is being questioned now by people from all different communities.
Well, we understand in India they've passed the Child Marriage Restraint Act, which restricts the age of consummation of a marriage. I think it's 18 for females, 21 for males, even though they may be promised sooner than that. Although, as you say, that law might not be followed, but it has been passed. And there's also the Dowry Prohibition Act of 1961, because I guess, you know, there were young girls who would commit suicide because the family couldn't afford a dowry and they felt they'd become a financial burden to their parents.
Sure. And I mean, we see this in other parts of the world. In Vietnam in the 1950s, there was a marriage and family law which strongly acted against arranged marriage. I think the important thing is that when we use this term arranged marriage, we must be careful, because it's the case that in many, many marriages, it's semi-arranged now around the world. A couple will be introduced, they're encouraged to date, they're encouraged to spend time together. It may be the case, though, that they still have some veto. Now, as they get older, particularly the woman gets older, maybe gets towards her 30s, say, there's going to be more and more pressure to accept one of the people that she's been pushed towards. It's not so clear-cut as turn up on the marriage day, meet the person for the first time, at least mainly not within the Hindu community in India, for example.
In fact, it's starting to sound like marriages sound in a lot of cultural groups that wouldn't consider them arranged marriages. It's just relatives nudging you.
Sure. And I think the range of people available to you may be more limited. For example, it will be very difficult for many Hindus in India, or Hindus, in fact, in the UK too, to marry someone from outside their religion. But at the same time, the old restrictions on marrying within caste may have disappeared. So you may have a broader range of people. who may be able to marry someone who's not traditionally seen as a suitable partner. But as long as they marry within the religion, that's generally accepted. And what you'll have is that people, as I said, will maybe be able to spend a little time, maybe even unaccompanied by other people, just meeting the person before the marriage and so on, just having some opportunity to date a little bit. That dating pattern is more prevalent amongst the middle and upper classes. In the poorer communities, maybe there's less opportunity for that. But even that, in a country like India, is changing very fast.
It sounds like it's being, you know, globalized.
I think it's been globalized. I think the other thing is that the complication is, of course, where you've got some of the more radical religious groups, particularly in Afghanistan with the Taliban and so on, re-traditionalizing marriage, making it actually more strict, more of a traditional arranged marriage. You even find that within China now. When things got privatized and people had their own plots of land and so on in the 80s, in fact, it was in the economic interest of the families to start arranging marriages again. So things went backwards.
That's Robin Goodwin. He's professor of social psychology at Brunel University in London. Well, we want to take a look now at arranged marriages in America, and we've got two guests to start us off. Thomas George lives in New York. He's 28. He's what would be described as a suitable boy, an eligible bachelor, and he's getting pressure to marry from his mom in India. Gina Kuravila lives here in Massachusetts. She's been in a marriage arranged by her parents back in India, where she was born, by the way, for 19 years. And Thomas is her husband's cousin, so they're related. And Gina, I want to start with you. We're hearing that these arrangements are vibrant in the U.S. You have two daughters. So first of all, do you want them to follow the same path you did?
All of my children are strong-willed. So there is absolutely no way that anyone would be able to arrange anything for them. But
I want to ask you, so are you not going to pass this down to them? I mean, your marriage was arranged, your parents was. Are you not going to pass it down to your daughters?
No, I'm not going to pass it down to my daughters. They're growing up in a different culture, and I think for the arranged marriage system to work, you have to belong to a particular mindset. You just go in with very few expectations, and you're prepared to compromise and adjust. You want to hang in there no matter what, and then eventually you understand and you get things to work. I don't see that happening in this culture. And I guess from their point of view, why should they go into a relationship where they would have to work very, very hard to make it work? And that's fine with me.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we've been reading articles by young Indian women, some of them expressing the feelings you're expressing. Others are saying that they don't understand dating. They come to the conclusion that that doesn't make as much sense as having sort of the pool of potential husbands limited by their parents.
I have an interesting anecdote about that, actually. One of my very close friends, who right now lives in Syracuse, New York, went through the whole dating scene, didn't really work out, decided to get married, told his mother to arrange something for him, went to India. His mother had lined up five girls, and he went for the first one. And his argument was that, I don't get time to get to know the person much. He was getting married in a few weeks. So first is the same as last. So he's here, and he's, as of now, it's been a year now, very happily married.
Huh.
So he went into it with an assumption that he has to make this arranged marriage work, and he did.
And although it is early still to say, Tom, because he's been married a year now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear some skepticism there from Gina Kuravila. She's in an arranged marriage, doesn't want one for her girls, but what about Thomas? We'll find out after a break. Talk about arranged marriages, common practices in many cultures, as we heard, but also popular here in the U.S. Our guests are Thomas George. He's 28. He's a project manager for a tech firm, and his mother back in India is putting some gentle pressure on him to have an arranged marriage. We're also joined by Gina Kuravila. She's been married for 19 years to a fellow named Joe. It's a marriage that was arranged by their families in India. She has two daughters but doesn't want them to have an arranged marriage. And Gina, just give us some background here. We read that when an Indian child is born, one of the first words they learn is shadi, for marriage. But what was your sense of marriage growing up?
I think that's an exaggeration, actually, to say that when an Indian child is born, one of the first words they hear is shadi. Certainly there is, an operating premise here that the single life is not the suitable life. But it isn't forced down anyone's throats in the way that statement makes it sound, at least to me. My experience growing up was, yes, there was an understanding that eventually, especially being female, marriage was in the cards. But the element of coercion that the statement implies was certainly not there.
How about, Thomas, what we're hearing? And again, I sat at a dinner with some young female doctors who said they couldn't go wait to check the website because they actually were excited about seeing, you know, who might have responded to ads their parents had put there. How much has it changed in America because of the use of the Internet? Is your mom using that?
Definitely not my mom, but I know because a few of my friends have got married recently, and it's still quite a bit of the family... family, friends, and culture, and all that comes in. But internet is playing a role more and more. Shaadi.com is very, very popular. I mean, I find it funny going there, and the descriptions, unlike the eHarmony and stuff in US, the ads are usually put by parents, not by the person themselves. So it's written in a different way. It's written in how the parents view their kids, not how they view themselves.
So give me some examples.
For example, if it's a dating website here, it would involve descriptions of their hobbies and what they like and stuff. And because it's written by their parents, Shaadi.com would have something like, it's been a while since I've been there, but it would have something like seeking a match for my daughter who is
very fair
and
would be,
homely,
yeah.
and cooks well. And
exactly.
Wait, Gina, you're laughing, but we hear that homely is a word that's used a lot, and by that it's meant likes to be in the home, right? Is domestic?
Yes, and also it means fairly submissive, will not talk out of turn, will not speak out of turn, will not be argumentative, will have no strong opinion. That's homely. generally, someone who will be happy to blend with the wallpaper.
Thomas, have you made up your mind? Are you going to go the route of your mom? I mean, is that definitive?
No. Right now, it's open because I actually do not want to get married right now. It doesn't matter if it's arranged marriage or not arranged marriage or dating or whatever. This is not the time. I have my career ahead of me. I have work to do. I have stuff to take care of. So that's the main thing. So I'm just... delaying it, that's all.
Thomas, what happens? You're trying to decide whether or not you want to, you know, ultimately when you do get married, have an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. What happens if you just fall in love? You fall in love with someone, she's not Indian.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
No, it's getting more and more acceptable. That's not a problem at all with my parents as it stands right now. I'm sure my parents won't be happy about it, but they will definitely accept it. It's reached a point where that's not seriously a problem.
A boundary shift, too. That's the other thing. If my daughters were in India, for instance, the networking would have begun by now. At least it would be in the background. When we went home a couple of years ago, there were families that met my children, and I could see the sizing up and the giving them the once-over, and people seemed to be happy with what they saw. So if we were living there, and I guess 5-6 years from now, we would have the proposals coming in for the girls. But boundary shift, because if we were in India, it would have to be somebody from the state that we belong to, and it would have to be someone Catholic. And now that we are here, what I frequently hear even with from the point of view of friends who are here, is that as long as it's someone Indian, it's okay, or as long as it's someone Hindu or Muslim or Christian, it's okay. I personally say that I'd be happy with anybody as long as the person was Christian, because the faith matters to me. So boundaries keep shifting.
I think it's reached a point where as long as it's a female, it doesn't matter, because homophobia is still a big thing in India.
Yes, I was going to come to that, because the other day we were all sitting together at lunch and talking, and there were a bunch of us mothers, and we were different people were saying, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, who are they going to date, and look at the high schools and all of that. And then one mother said, you know what, I have a daughter and I have a son. As long as my daughter marries a male, I'm okay. So that's there as well, and that's quite a shifting of boundaries.
Well, I want to wish you both a happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. You
Thank
too,
you.
Robin.
Thank you. and best to you. Gina Curlavilla lives here in Massachusetts. Thomas George lives in New York. He was speaking to us from California. Both Indian Americans, talking about the topic of arranged marriages, a very vibrant practice here in the United States. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps more shifting to come in India. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name and your phone number and your town. And this reminder, you can listen to Here Now anytime on our website, here-now.org. You can also download a podcast there as well. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Japanese-American writer Iris Yamashita reflects on her work in the Oscar-nominated film Letters from Iwo Jima. More ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. Earlier in the program, we heard from a Newsweek magazine correspondent that the Bush administration appears to be all over the map on what it's saying about Iranian involvement in Iraq. At his news conference today, the president said an arm of the Iranian government, the Quds Force, was instrumental in supplying explosives to Iraq, but he stopped short of saying Iranian leaders ordered it. Yesterday, the Pentagon's top general, Peter Pace, said the presence of Iranian-made explosives in Iraq doesn't necessarily mean Iranian leaders are directly involved. But in a briefing over the weekend, unnamed American officials in Baghdad did blame Iranian leaders. Well, we're joined by Borzu Daragahi, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, what are American and Iraqi officials in Iraq or in Baghdad saying today about this alleged link between weapons found in Iraq and the Iranian government?
It was interesting today, rather fascinating and surprising that U.S. military officials at a regularly scheduled briefing, this time on the record, this time with cameras and recording devices allowed, it seems like they kind of backtracked on some of the claims that were made at this presentation.
Do you have any idea why U.S. military officials seem to pull back from the claim of evidence in today's presser as opposed to earlier?
It was really interesting the way they were approaching it. The whole tone had shifted. They're saying, we are asking the Iranian government to stop this, to help stop this. I'm not sure why they were doing it this way. One of the things that General William Caldwell, who was giving the presentation, said was that the emphasis in the last presentation had been incorrect. You know, in effect, blaming the media, saying the media had focused on this one element of the presentation, which was creating this link between the ordinance that was there and the Iranian government, whereas their main purpose was not to do this. Their main purpose was to just emphasize this problem and talk about this problem.
And as you said, now the tone is asking the Iranian government to help them stop this problem, as opposed to blaming the Iranian government for it.
In fact, yes, and sort of these explosively formed penetrators, these very lethal weapons that the U.S. is concerned about and is suggesting they're coming from Iran. I asked an explosive expert who was there about this weapon. He was showing the weapon on in front of the cameras and so on, and I asked him, so how do you know this came from Iran? And he said that we know that it came from Iran because. It is, you know, the sort of the nature of the manufacturing is such that it couldn't have been made in Iraq. And we've seen similar weapons in Lebanon that were used by Hezbollah, the Hezbollah militia. And so I said to them, so wait, you don't have any forensic evidence tracing this back to Iran? He said, no, we don't have any forensic evidence tracing this back to Iran. And then I said, so really, it's an intelligence assessment that this is from Iran. It's not like you have a clear trail linking this back to Iran. It could have been theoretically made at a factory somewhere else. And he said, yes, indeed, you can say that it's more of an intelligence assessment than a forensic trail.
Well, yesterday the Iraqi government announced a new crackdown. Tell us what Lieutenant General Aboud Kambar, the Iraqi general in charge of the operation, is calling for.
Well, yeah, this is a call to Operation Law and Order. I mean, a lot of the stuff was just a little confusing. You know, they were basically restating what is, in essence, Iraqi law. They're going to ban all weapons on the street, you know, but, you know, each family can still have an AK-47 in their household. So I don't see any change there. One of the most interesting things was that they were ordering all people who are squatting in houses that don't belong to them to get out. This is a real volatile issue having to do with the displacement of Iraqis. You know, it just doesn't seem realistic. They gave people a 15-day time limit to get out, and it's just not plausible that, you know, that this can be unraveled that quickly. There was other steps, tightening of border controls for 72 hours, moving the curfew 1 hour back so that people have to be home by 8 o'clock instead of 9 o'clock. And there was also an announcement on restrictions of freedom of assembly, more monitoring of electronic and postal communications and so on. So, you know, just a kind of a crackdown.
Well, you mentioned a move to have people show deeds to homes to try to get people out of homes that they don't own. And that brings us to a very poignant article that your translator wrote today in the paper, an account of what happened to his parents' home in West Baghdad that reportedly his parents had to flee the country after being tortured by attackers previously. And this is the home he grew up in, and now he's told that there are gunmen living there.
Yeah, poor Saeed. He just walked in one day. He's like, oh, my house has been jacked. It's been taken. And he's trying to figure out what to do about it. And there was a sort of comical element. If you know Saeed, he's a very good-natured young man, very brave, gutsy guy. And the way he was dealing with it was quite funny and sardonic, this whole tragedy of his house being taken over. He's still terrified of going over there and seeing what happened.
Why doesn't he call the Iraqi police or U.S. coalition forces?
Well, I mean, in the past, when there's been trouble and he's gotten in touch with law enforcement, that hasn't done anything. It could potentially exacerbate the problem. You know, it could put him on someone's list. You never know who the good guys are in Iraq. You never know who the bad guys are. So you just have to assume that everyone is a bad guy.
He says his neighborhood is now controlled by a notorious Sunni Arab politician who may have sanctioned the takeover. And he doesn't want to draw attention to himself by going to Americans because people might find out he works with the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is not something he wanted to bring up with this particular individual.
Meanwhile, the list of things that's in the house, his mother's jewelry, the film of his parents' wedding, 50 years of family history, high school yearbooks, his swimming and basketball trophies.
Yeah, you know, his life is in there. The family heirlooms are in that house. You know, it's a really awful situation in Iraq with ordinary people. They've been pretty much, you know, especially middle class people that Americans could identify with. They've really been totally devastated by this whole conflict. Those are the people who are really hurting and really suffering. The average, ordinary, everyday people who want to lead a normal life, you know, are generally more secular than the rest of the population. Those are the people who are fleeing and really suffering right now.
Well, meanwhile, Borzu, you say the government's going to make an effort to try to get squatters out of houses, not knowing, you know, who's who.
Robin, it's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, let's just be candid here. This is just hyperbole. They're just making announcements on the TV. There's no way they can get all these people to leave these houses in 15 days, A. B, a lot of these people who are squatting houses, they're not just, you know, some roaming caravan of bums or something. These are people who've been removed from their houses in their neighborhoods or their communities, and so they have nowhere else to live except to live in a house that's been vacated by someone else. So this is a true tragedy. They're not going to be able to unravel this in 15 days. It's a joke.
Well, in the meantime, Borzu, we hear your frustration, but we also hear from the Bush administration today that they now are announcing they're going to allow about 7,000 Iraqi refugees into the U.S. over the next year. That's compared with 463 only that have been allowed in since the war began, and a lot of people have been pushing for more Iraqis to be given refugee status and to come to the U.S. But do you think 7,000 is going to do it?
I think that 7,000 is a drop in the bucket. I mean, think about it. There's a million Iraqis living in Jordan alone. So I don't think that 7,000 is going to really, it's not even a Band-Aid.
Borzu Daragahi, Los Angeles Times Baghdad Bureau Chief, speaking to us from Baghdad. Borzu, thanks so much as always.
It's been a pleasure.
And this brief reminder, well, we're also trying to mark Valentine's Day, which becomes increasingly hard with the news. But still to come, love stories ripped from the New York Times style section. That's later. You're listening to Here and Now. And now to the view of Iraq from Congress. We want to give you an opportunity to listen in. It's day two of House debate on a resolution that would denounce President Bush's increase in troops in Iraq. Democrats say the resolution, while it's non-binding, is the first step in changing the course of the war. Republicans who oppose the measure say passage would put the nation at risk and would send a disturbing message to the troops. Well, today, Democratic Congressman Steny Hoyer of Maryland took issue with that.
Some say that the resolution will demoralize our troops. In a democracy, it is proper and essential that we debate the tactics and strategy we are employing when we are asking young Americans, and some not so young Americans, to be at the point of the spear. It is easy for us to talk about tactics and strategy, not so easy for those who are in harm's way. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Pace, says this debate will not adversely affect morale if we make it clear, as we have made it clear over and over and over again, that we will not abandon, we will not underman, we will not undersupply, we will not undertrain, and we will not defund those who we have put in harm's way. We will support our troops today, tomorrow, and every day thereafter.
But Republican Kay Granger of Texas said if this resolution passes, it will signal to the world that the U.S. is retreating in Iraq, one of the front lines, she said, in the global war on terrorism.
With all my heart, I believe we stand at a crucial crossroad where the decision we make will affect not just us, but our children and their children and generations to come. Our enemies have demonstrated that they are willing to kill us, even if they have to die themselves. Thankfully, our servicemen and women are willing to bravely defend our freedom as we in Congress go through the semantics of debating a non-binding resolution. For this reason and all the other reasons I've outlined today, I will not support a resolution that sends anything less than a clear message of support for our troops who are deployed in harm's way. The non-binding resolution before us is at best confusing, at worst immoral. It pledges to support the troops in the field, but washes its hands of what they're doing. We can't have it both ways. We can't say that our military men and women have our full support while disapproving of their mission on the eve of their battle. The bill is not resolved to do anything. It doesn't offer a solution. It only offers political, expedient top cover.
Well, the debate in Congress comes as the war in Iraq approaches the four-year mark. More than 3,100 U.S. troops have died there. It also comes, as we've been hearing, as Iran's role in Iraq is under scrutiny. One congressman, Peter DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon, said Congress should support the resolution criticizing a surge in troops in Iraq because the war was built on what he called phony intelligence. And he implied the same thing is happening again with Iran, pointing to the story we've been talking about, a top general saying Iranian weapons in Iraq doesn't mean the Iranian government is involved.
On Sunday, we had unidentified sources saying that the highest levels of the Iranian government have directed use of weapons that are killing U.S. troops. No information was provided to substantiate the charge. Administration officials yesterday deflected requests for more details, even as they repeatedly implied Tehran's involvement. It may or may not be true, but they got a pretty bad record on intelligence. And now Major General Peter Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said yesterday he has no information indicating Iran's government is directing the supply of lethal weapons to Shiite insurgent groups in Iraq. Sounds like the Iraq war intelligence all over again.
Democratic Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon. Republican leaders acknowledge they are likely to lose the vote. It is expected to come on Friday. We'll continue to follow the debate in Congress for you. Well, after the break, where is the love? It's in the New York Times Modern Love column, as you'll hear. That's ahead here and now. Earlier in the program, we talked about arranged marriages. Well, do you remember the New York Times story about the Harvard student whose Indian parents were searching in vain in Indiana for a suitable mate for her? The title of the column was "Mom, Dad, Let Me Find My Own Husband." It was one of many in the New York Times style section Sunday column, Modern Love. Some of the others: the woman who marries a trophy husband, the daughter who finds out after her father dies that his fishing buddy knew more about him than his family did. That was a personal favorite. Or the one about the widower finding love again after the death of his beloved wife.
Late one night, after agonizing about it for days, do I really? Yeah. Is it time? Maybe. Will I scare her off? Probably not, but maybe. Am I really sure? Yeah. I tell Suzanne that I love her. What did you say? You're mumbling. I repeat myself, trying my best to articulate and project. I love you. I feel relieved and happy, but also guilty. For 14 years, those words belonged only to Kirsten, but now they also belong to Suzanne. And so, for the first time in my life, I find myself in love with two women at the same time. If both were alive, this would constitute a pretty serious problem.
That's Brendan Halpin reading from his first-person Modern Love account. His is one of the many columns collected with updates in the new book, Modern Love, 50 True and Extraordinary Tales of Desire, Deceit, and, as we just heard, Devotion. We'll talk to Brendan in a moment. But first, editor Daniel Jones joins us on the line from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
And you're not only the editor of the book, but of the column. Do you hear from a lot of people? I mean, do a lot of people want to be in it?
We get hundreds of submissions every month. Yeah,
I bet you do.
The confessions pour in.
Just tick through, and I'll start with some of the topics that, you know, who expects to find a gay high schooler who gets asked to take everyone else to the prom, all the girls to the prom when they need a date. Someone goes through a relationship, the entire arc, almost entirely through text messaging.
There's one called The Third Half of a Couple, where a guy who can't find a date or is so uncomfortable around women, and he gloms onto a married couple and becomes the stability of their marriage, and tagging along with them to everything is where, you know, he finds his relationship.
Right. Some of the columns are flippant, and then some just break your heart. And that brings us to one of your contributors who's sitting here with me, Brendan Halpin from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. And Brendan, you read a little bit of your column in the introduction about your wife dying of cancer, was it?
Yeah, breast cancer.
And then just trying to figure out what you do from there. I remember reading that and I was like, oh, God. You know, tell us more about what was happening to you when you were in love with two women.
Well, it was just a very strange experience to mix that elation of infatuation with grief. But having spent several months in the sort of, you know, grief and despair stage, adding some elation and joy into the mix was a really happy addition.
And this was the woman that you began dating, that you write about, that you've ultimately married and blended your families.
Yes.
You both had kids.
Yes.
You write in your essay for Modern Love about a dream that you had that became a metaphor, that you and your late wife, Kirsten, had gone to a mall.
Right. And she went up to the bookstore, which is on the third floor, and I was going with her. And then I realized, well, where's Rowan, our daughter Rowan? She was very unconcerned and was like, well, you have to go get her, which was, you know, just completely unlike her when she was alive. And I was, like, a little annoyed with her in the dream. I was like, well, geez, all right. So, you know, I go running down to the ground floor, and there's Rowan, and I just sort of threw my arms around her, and then I woke up. I felt like that was sort of either my subconscious or, you know, Kirsten or something telling me that I was where I belong. She was moving on. I mean, she had moved on.
It's a lovely thought, but as you write, you're really annoyed with your subconscious for choosing a mall. But at least Kirsten's in the bookstore.
Right. I mean, you know, if if that's an accurate vision of the afterlife, yeah. I'm sure she's content. But,
and Daniel, when this comes across your desk, it's so beautifully written. As it turns out, Brendan is a writer. But stories like this are often from people who just, you know, they've never written, and they're putting out this incredibly personal thing. What are you thinking when you're reading these?
Part of my vision for the column is to have a real broad base of experience and have people really from all over. And, you know, you mentioned earlier an 18-year-old high school student writing about what it's like to be invited to all these proms as a gay, you know, sort of escort. You don't find stories like that by conceiving them yourself and trying to find someone to write it. You'd need to rely on people, some often, you know, who aren't writers, to send them in.
What is it, Brendan, for you? Because there's a lot of personal stuff in here about, you know, kissing a new woman, feeling like you're betraying your late wife. And What was that like for you to write it, and then it's out there, style section, everyone sees it?
What was hard for me in writing this, and one of the reasons that I really wanted to write on this topic, was actually revisiting the time when Kirsten was dying. This was the first thing that I wrote about that, and that was the part that was really difficult for me to write. In terms of stuff being out there in front of people, I think there's some shame part that's missing in my brain because I just didn't care. Like, I don't know.
But yours was a column that just, you know, you read it aching and loving the ache. Others, Daniel, I've read and I've thought, what is this person thinking, telling me about this affair she had with the younger man? Or I think I already know the answer. Do you ever, like, you want to contact someone and say, really, I don't know if you, do you really want that in the New York Times?
I ask that every so often. I do feel about the column that honesty is disarming. And people who step out there and say, this is my life, these are my flaws, these are my conflicts, and this is what I've done, it can make a reader sit back in a maybe sort of morbid fascination, but also admiration.
Well, and in some, they don't name names. I'm thinking of the one when a girl has an affair with a married musician and she's so thinking he's so into her. And then as she travels on his website, she gets through to a link of another girl having an affair with
right.
a musician. And she's right out there. I mean, her name, the first girl who was having the affair, her name's right on the article.
That's one interesting thing about doing this in a newspaper. We have to follow the rules of the newspaper. You know, a lot of these pieces, when they appear in a magazine, it'll be with a pseudonym and with changed names and changed details. And we aren't allowed to do that. So you do have to own up to your experience and put your name on it.
Yeah. She calls herself a blog stalker, you know, as she went deeper in to try to find the other mistress of the musician she had been having the affair with. And that brings to mind something that you write in the introduction, that a lot of these essays involve modern technology. You know, we think modern technology has in many ways changed love, but has it really? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there are two parts to that. I mean, love never changes. You know, for hundreds of years and thousands of years, we all have the same emotions and jealousies and conflicts. But the means change, and technology has, it's created this smorgasbord of love, you know, and opportunity where someone used to be limited by the people who live near them, and now there they are, this vast sea of faces of people who are looking for somebody else. God, I don't know. I'm not on the prowl right now myself, but if I were, I'd find that a little overwhelming.
Do you have people who write to you about these stories? I mean, what do readers say about them? And are there some that, you know, have really had more response than others?
Yes, and this was a surprise to me. I expected when we posted an email address that we would get, you know, nicely written letters to the editor that said, this is a very nicely written essay, or this is a very badly written essay, or this is a typo in the piece. Instead, the vast majority of responses are people writing in to say, I went through that too, and here's my story. It's a very private thing being put into a very public forum, and it creates all these little intimate connections, reader to writer, that I find sort of extraordinary.
I just wanted to add that, you know, this was really the piece of my work that I've gotten more response. I mean, as Dan said earlier, the emails just poured in with people, you know, telling me their stories. And, you know, so I am thrilled to be in here because it really is something that a lot of people connected with.
Brendan Halpin's piece is in the new book, Modern Love, 52 and Extraordinary Tales of Desire, Deceit, and Devotion. We also spoke with editor Daniel Jones. And I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Happy Valentine's Day in whatever form that may take for you. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for